What secrets are the Koch brothers keeping? Nicholas Lemon joins us to talk about his review of Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Family by Daniel Shulman.
They don't have to issue a lot of public statements, so a lot of what you know about them is lawsuits they've been involved in.
Just how much does the Chinese government want to forget the events of Tiananmen Square? Louisa Lim speaks to us about her new book, The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited.
This year, for the first time, we've seen a lot of detentions of people who have held private remembrances of the events of June the 4th.
My colleagues John Williams, Carl Sagal, and I will chat about what's going on this week in the book business, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Nicholas Lemon is here to talk about his review of Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty by Daniel Shulman, reviewed this week in the Book Review. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
So this book came with a big embargo, as it's called in the business, meaning that there is supposedly news in here that or information that was not previously known. To what extent is there new information in here?
I guess what I would say is Mr. Shulman did a very, very thorough reporting job, but he's constrained by the fact that he's writing about a family none of whose members would really talk to him, and you know they don't generally talk to reporters. So there's a big paper trail of lawsuits and some archival material, but there isn't a lot of interview material. The two things that I thought were the most sort of newsworthy in the book, one, he has a very brief meeting with Frederick Koch, the little-known oldest brother, just to talk about whether he'll cooperate with the book, and the meeting ends with a decision that he won't. So that's that. That's one little snip of three or four pages in the book. And then there's a letter, I quote this in the review, from the family patriarch Fred Koch that Shulman found in an archive, written to a friend in the 1930s, sort of saying, well, the only countries that really have functional governments are Germany, Japan, and Italy. So that's a good line.
What do those countries have in common?
So that's a good line. But again, that's not sort of, I don't know if you call it investigative reporting. It's in a public archive.
Right.
But he had the enterprise to find it. And then, you know, there's an enormous amount of suing each other and other people suing them. And so that produces a big paper trail.
All right. I'm going to now pull back, and for those who are not obsessed with the quote-unquote right-wing conspiracy and don't know who the Koch brothers are, let's talk about who this family is. The patriarch is Fred Koch, and there are four brothers.
So it's a family that lives or is based in Wichita, Kansas. The patriarch, Fred Koch, who was born in 1900, is a classic kind of self-made oil man from the first half of the 20th century, and he grew up in Texas and then wound up in Wichita after getting an education at MIT and had a sort of oil field engineering company that has expanded through his sons to become a huge conglomerate. But certainly, it seems as if by the time he was 30, Fred Koch was very rich. And as was true of virtually 100% of self-made oil millionaires in the Southwest in those days, he was supremely right-wing as well, maybe even unusually right-wing among that group.
And he was one of the founders of the John Birch Society.
Yes, he was. And that's another little nugget in the book, not from a secret source, but it's interesting. There was a meeting in Indianapolis to found the John Birch Society, and Fred Koch was one of those at the meeting.
So there are four brothers. I think the two that are most familiar to those who follow Republican politics and the funding thereof, Charles and David.
Yep.
Let's talk about Fred and William.
Okay. Frederick is the oldest of the brothers. You know, with all due respect to the Times lawyers, the author of the book very much finds him to be gay, although he has always denied that. But he never got along with his father, the founder of the dynasty, never worked in the family company, and has spent his life sort of pursuing cultural and artistic interests, and he's a big art collector and so on. All these brothers live incredibly lavishly, by the way.
He has an apartment on Fifth Avenue that's just for his artwork and not.
Yeah, well, he has a townhouse on the east side that's just for his artwork, and then a nearby apartment where he lives when he's in New York, but that's only one of many houses he owns. And Frederick went to, from family standards, the wrong college, Harvard. Everybody else went to MIT, and so he's not technically inclined.
Just to give a sense of the scale of the fortune here, you have a statistic in your review: $70 million in 1960 was the estimate for revenues at Koch Industries, and $90 billion in 2006.
Yes, and it's a privately held company. So, you know, with a publicly held company, you can find out lots and lots and lots of stuff about what goes on in the company. And with a privately held, you cannot. So we don't know a lot. It's the second biggest privately owned company in the United States, and has always been private. The family wealth is, you know, you could go to Forbes or take a guess, but it's clearly in the billions. But back to the brothers. So Frederick is the aesthetically inclined older one who didn't work in the business. Charles is number two and sort of the person who runs the business and has for many decades now. David and William are the youngest, and they're twins. David is the one that people in New York, at least, will know most about because he lives here. He's a big New York philanthropist, and he's always has his picture in the paper.
And many buildings named after him at this point.
Yeah, buildings named after him. Charles lives in Wichita and is much less sort of in the public eye. William is the troublemaking brother who did work in the family business for a while, left, and began 20 years of relentless legal warfare against the company and his middle brothers, sometimes enlisting Frederick as an ally. So he's now built his own successful private business, but they all have kind of big personalities, but he seems to have the biggest.
Now, is he politically liberal? Is there a political clash?
It's hard to figure that out from what we know. William gave a lot of money to the Romney campaign, mm-hmm. so he's not liberal by the standards of Upper West Side New York. He's probably more liberal than his brothers, and at one point was threatening to run for office in Kansas as a Democrat. But he isn't in any way, you know, the George Soros type big money liberal donor.
Right.
He's closer to where his brothers are. And they've since, after 20 years of fighting, sort of patched it up, according to the book. So he's less incentivized to separate himself from them politically.
I want to talk about that little rapprochement after, but just to talk more about the politics specifically, they are sort of, they've become the bad guys in a certain narrative of political fundraising, that they're the ones that are funding the Republican Party, but their politics are kind of a specific niche. They're not traditional Republicans. They're more libertarians.
Right. So Daniel Shulman, the author, makes an interesting argument about them, which is, you know, they started as people who didn't want to be active in the Republican Party and who had no influence in the Republican Party. David Koch presumably did not vote for Ronald Reagan for president because he was running for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket.
In 1980.
And they started the Cato Institute, the leading libertarian think tank in the United States. So they were always very interested in politics, always very conservative, but there's a lot of different kinds of conservative. And they were the kind that at least Charles and David were libertarians. And what's interesting about them is both sides of the question. Why did they decide to join the Republican Party, you know, more than notionally? And then why did the Republican Party decide to have them when they had been considered outsiders who were destructive to the party? So that's what's interesting, is how they didn't enter politics through the Republican doorway. They entered through the Libertarian doorway.
And are they considered, I mean, does he, how closely does he track to their donations? Do they donate primarily to Tea Party candidates? Are they?
It's a little hard to tell because despite all of our campaign finance disclosure laws, some of this stuff is a little hard to find because it's shielded, especially after the Citizens United decision. But no, I think what it appears from the book is it's not all Tea Party. The Tea Party's financing is not all Koch brothers, and conversely, the Koch brothers' financial and organizing input isn't all Tea Party. They operate on a lot of different levels and clearly support people like Mitt Romney, too.
I think another thing people are not very clear on, and I don't know if this book helps clarify, but what is Koch Industries? We know that it started in oil. We know that the brothers are very active in trying to decrease the number of environmental regulations, energy regulations. What do they actually do?
It's honestly a little hard to answer that question in the sort of McKinsey consultant business school sense from reading the book because they don't have to issue a lot of public statements. So a lot of what you know about them is lawsuits they've been involved in. The original Fred Koch was a chemical engineer who didn't actually drill for oil, but provided various engineering-related services to the oil industry, particularly pipelines. And since then, the company has diversified, but it seems as if most of what it does has a sort of chemical flavor to it, and that would give them a reason to be hostile to environmental regulation. And they're also, of course, libertarian. Shulman is relatively kind to them, I think, and he definitely says they're not businessmen who are pretending to have an ideology as a cover for their business interests. They actually do have an ideology as well as business interests. So he gives them credit for sincerity in their beliefs and says there's certain kinds of, you know, Washington games that people in business play of, you know, I'll support a candidate I don't really think is good if he'll support me on this bill. And according to him, they will not do that sort of thing. They're purists.
Okay, so ideologues as opposed to pragmatists.
And, you know, as libertarians, they're generally very supportive of gay marriage, for example,
right. And
have been for years.
Shulman, we should say, is an editor at Mother Jones. He's not exactly coming from a neutral, position here.
So they're not in a place that liberals would think of as standard right wing on every issue.
As a reader going into this book, and obviously you as the Dean Emeritus of Columbia Journalism School and a writer at The New Yorker are familiar with the Koch brothers. Did your own impression of them change after reading the book?
Not so much. I mean, I definitely learned a lot about them. It's very useful. There's a huge amount of material out there on the Kochs, and Shulman performs a very useful service by essentially saying, I'm going to put this all together for you, sift it, take out what's interesting, and turn it into a coherent, understandable, compelling narrative, and that he has done. So this is a good place to learn about them. I didn't find I had a huge surprise. I guess I hadn't quite realized, only because I hadn't been following their every move for the last 30 years, exactly how involved they were in suing each other and, as my kids would say, hating on each other for so long.
Your colleague Jane Mayer, of course, did a very interesting and I think influential piece for The New Yorker. Was it last year or the year before?
I think it was 2010.
Okay. 4 years ago on the Koch brothers. But I think that she focused more on their current political activities,
right,
a little bit the family history, but not this inter...
Yeah, this book is sort of gotten up as a family saga. So it has political stuff in there, but that's not the majority of the book. And I'd say the heart of the book is the story of the family dynasty and how it was built to some extent, and particularly on the very elaborate feuding among the brothers and their rather spectacularly messy, in some cases, or interesting personal lives. Many divorces and financial settlements and yachts and wine collections and lawsuits and private detectives and stuff like that.
Fascinating family. The book is Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty by Daniel Shulman. Review this week by Nick Lemon. Nick, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
My colleagues Pearl Siegel and John Williams join me now to talk about what's going on in the book business. Hi, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
So let's start with someone who is not yet a household name, may still be an unpronounceable name to many, Karl Ove Knausgård.
Well done.
Who is he?
Knausgård is a Norwegian novelist who's written several books and is now becoming very famous in certain circles for a 6-part autobiographical novel called My Struggle. The first 2 volumes have already been released in the U.S. and the 3rd is coming soon. And the 3 after that, I think, are going to follow in fairly quick succession.
There's so much about this that should be automatically de facto a turnoff.
That's right.
Norwegian author, in translation, not a dark thriller.
Mm-hmm.
A title which is reminiscent of a certain Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
A 6-part, how many pages?
I think it's about 3,600. Well, total, I think it's 3,600 pages.
3,600 page and then autobiographical novel.
And let's add that nothing particularly incredible has happened to this person.
Who isn't he?
Ulysses Grant.
What does happen? Who is he?
Well, not much happens, and I think that's why people are talking about it, because he makes, some believe, art out of incredibly mundane details and very long stretches of prose about things like a child's birthday party or getting ready for a New Year's Eve party. And there are digressions about what he thinks about love and marriage and parenting, but nothing really happens. And that's gotten it compared to Proust a little bit, but I think actually, Proust is very eventful compared to these books, and obviously Proust is a very great stylist, whereas some people think that Knausgård's power comes from an almost anti-style, where
that's
it's
right.
just very straightforward and plain, but it accrues this kind of odd power over time.
So you're using this very diplomatic some people. You've both read some of Knausgård.
Yeah.
What do you think of the writing?
I think it's, I think this is why so many writers love Knausgård, because he breaks all the rules. He does everything you're not supposed to do. He uses cliche. Everything is described with the same sort of granular detail, be it like the death of his father or eating a bowl of cornflakes.
So many aspiring memoirs listening to this are now getting excited that they too might.
And it confuses people. Like he generally has received extremely positive reviews. He got one negative review in The Nation by William Dereshowitz, who calls it like one giant selfie and is very angry about it. But I think that for the people who love him, part of what becomes part of the project is one's own response to the material, right? And so one's own boredom, one's own sort of, and I think Zadie Smith said that you sort of like, you live that life along with your own, which is what people have said about Proust. It's like having another unconscious. So I think that's what people are responding to.
You know, I'm only about 100 pages into the first volume, and I don't find it, I think boring is a weird word, because I don't think anyone, people are calling that a quality as if it's a strength, but I don't think anyone would continue reading something for that long if they were actually bored. I think what they mean is that he sort of transforms boredom into something that is really interesting, because you follow his, you know, mental
sounds
pathways.
Sounds like an alchemist.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there is something about that, because it's very hard to explain why this works.
That's
and there
right,
is something
yeah.
kind of magical about that. At the same time, I wonder if Liesl Schillinger, who's a frequent contributor to the Book Review, wrote a piece in the Daily Paper this week about writers' reactions to him and why they sort of worship him as much as they do at the current moment. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about how he's sort of done something that no one else has done before, and I think that's a little bit overblown. I think that people like Edward St. Aubyn most recently, his Patrick Melrose novels were heavily autobiographical, heavily about family scenes in which not a ton happens, but you're sort of
very
inside.
Stylized.
Yeah.
Right.
And very
right.
brief, we should say.
Yeah.
Very,
well,
yeah.
relatively. His 5 novels, you know, relatively brief novels compared to the 6 and 4,000 pages of Knausgård. But I also think that there's just a way in which we've really privileged the fantastical in recent years, and werewolves and all of that has become very literary in a way. And this is, I think, a long tradition of writing about everyday life and everyday thought that he's sort of recharging.
I disagree with you. I have to say, no. I mean, I think you're totally right.
It's
because this is not that's
on
right.
the NYTBR
no,
book.
No, you're totally right. Like, I think that in a certain way we've seen this before, but I don't think we've ever seen this kind of scope. I don't think actually we've seen men writing about domesticity like this.
Mm.
He's the primary caregiver to, you know, 4 little children. There's also been this public fallout about writing this book. You know, he wrote about leaving his wife and falling in love with another woman and creating another family, and writing like incredibly personal details about his own family. He's been denounced. So some of this, I don't think we've seen. But
I think some of the denouncing though is happening. I mean, in Norway, this was very much a water cooler book.
That's
I mean,
right.
everyone
I think that's
read
right.
it and
yes.
talked about
yeah.
it.
The statistics I found in Liesl's piece were really startling. In that country of 5 million people, 500,000 copies of this were sold. to the point that certain corporations banned talk of Knausgaard on certain work days just so that they could, you know, get something done.
That's completely insane. And I think the equivalent of what? That would be like 50 million books sold in the U.S. or something like that.
Right.
But it's like people
only
tuning
in Norway.
Yeah. But it's like the way people tune into reality TV, which I think is the point that you're kind of making and Dreschowitz is making, is that oversharing isn't so new and isn't so...
Right.
You know,
that said, I'm enjoying the book, and I also haven't gotten to the part of, you know, the deep parenting aspects of it. So I'm sure that my opinions will change as I continue to read.
One more topic to cover this week. Yeah. Tom Wolfe, very American author, was also written about in our pages earlier this week by Jenny Schuessler. What's going on with Mr. Wolfe?
Well, Jenny got a sneak peek at a great trove of material, which is Wolfe's personal archive, which the New York Public Library purchased last year for over $2 million. So I'm saving my emails just in, you know, just in case anyone, $50. We'll start there.
And isn't it a shame that you can't do anything with your famous email?
I'll do something with John's emails.
Okay.
Yes, something very entertaining, I'm sure. And I think that this is something that will eventually obviously be available for the public, is now currently being processed in Queens, where Jenny got to go and kind of sneak a peek. And online, there's a really great slideshow of images of different letters and invitations and things that he sent to people. And it really covers everything from letters to famous friends like Hunter S. Thompson and William F. Buckley
an odd pairing.
That's right. Yeah, he had diverse friends.
Deranged
or has diverse friends. And then she even mentions, you know, that there are a lot of sketches of elaborate instructions to tailors, which, you know, given that it's Tom Wolfe, makes a lot of sense, actually.
The white suits must be exactly right. Okay, well, when will any of that be on view for people who may be Tom Wolfe fans themselves?
I don't think that's entirely clear yet. I don't think they have a firm date in mind, but people who want a sneak peek should definitely go online and look at Jenny's piece because it offers a lot of detail beforehand.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Louisa Lim joins us now. She is the author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited, reviewed this week in the book review by Jonathan Mirsky. Hi, Louisa.
Hi, Pamela.
So you have been a correspondent from Beijing for quite a number of years, both for NPR and the BBC. Was it during that time that you decided to write this book?
Yes, that's right. I first went out to work as a foreign correspondent in Beijing for the BBC in 2003. And then around 2006, I started working for NPR. But, you know, it wasn't something that I'd been thinking of all the way along. It was something that really I started thinking about in recent years, and it just started to bother me that no one had written this book, that no one was talking about the legacy of Tiananmen inside China and writing it from the inside. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I really felt that it was a book that needed to be written.
Now, it's been 25 years since the events of 1989. When you're in China, does it feel like something that's constantly there? Is it under the surface, or is it, given your title, something that people seem to be trying to forget, or the government is trying to forget?
Yes, it's a really weird kind of mix of all of those things. It's not something that is openly talked about among people. It's something the government doesn't want people to talk about. It's not in schools. It's not taught in history classes. As an experiment for my book, I went around the university, four of the top universities in Beijing, with the picture that we know of as Tank Man, you know, the Chinese man standing in front of a line of tanks. And I just wanted to see whether kids in the universities recognize that today, given the internet and the fact that there is a little more freedom of information. And I was really surprised to find that only 15 out of 100 students could recognize it or would admit to recognizing it. But I was also really surprised at how nervous I was, at how much I myself had internalized that the whole censorship regime. So it is something that's hard to talk about. And even online, you know, any mention of June the 4th is censored. So people try and find all ways of getting around the censors by, for example, instead of talking about June the 4th, talking about May the 35th. And there's always this kind of constant cat and mouse chase going on online to delete references to it. This year, for the first time, we've seen a lot of detentions of people who have held private remembrances of the events of June the 4th, sometimes, you know, inside private homes.
It's amazing the challenge it must pose for the Chinese government when you think of Tiananmen. The actual square holds a very central place in Beijing, and there's enormous amounts of history. You have Mao in the square, and yet at the same time, these events that they want people to ignore.
Yes. As you mentioned, the whole geographic aspect of it is really difficult for the government to deal with. And you can see in the days leading up to the anniversary every year, they really tighten security. They start putting up checkpoints, checking people's bags when they go into Tiananmen Square. And I mean, one year on the 20th anniversary, when the foreign television crews arrived on the square to film their pieces to camera, and they had applied for these special permits to do that, there was so much paranoia on the part of the government that they actually deployed these plainclothes policemen with umbrellas, and their job was to stand in between the foreign correspondents and their cameras and put up their umbrellas and get in the way so these correspondents couldn't do their pieces to camera. So it is, for the Chinese government, controlling what happens within that piece of ground, which they tend to see as almost as a kind of sacred piece of ground, is becoming harder and harder.
I think that makes it very clear for listeners and for readers of your book just what a brave piece of reporting this is, not just on your part, but also the many people who you interviewed who spoke with you.
Yes, I mean, for them, the risk was far greater than it was for me. We've already seen one person who I interviewed who is an artist, but he had been a soldier who was part of the martial law troops deployed to put down the protests in 1989. He has actually been detained and is still in police detention because he put on a piece of performance art a couple of weeks ago in an empty building, and he invited a dozen friends. And for that, he's been detained. Nobody knows the charges. So there is a huge risk, and there was a huge risk for people in talking to me. In many cases, they decided to speak to me because I really think they believe that 25 years has passed, and how many more chances would they have to tell their stories?
Right. Tell us some of their stories. Tell us the story of Wang Nan.
So Wang Nan was a 19-year-old high schooler at the time of the protests, and he was a very good kid. He was the kind of kid who carries bottles of hot water upstairs for the teachers and who's really hardworking. And on the bus going between home and school, he used to pass Tiananmen Square and see the students, and he got very, very interested in what was happening, and he wanted to be a photojournalist, so he wanted to go and record history in the making. So he kept going to the square, and on the night of June the 3rd to June the 4th, when the martial law troops rolled into Beijing, all 150,000 of them, he sneaked out of his parents' house, and he was in the streets, and he dashed forward to take a picture of the troops, and he was shot in the head with one bullet to the head. It was what happened next that was truly shocking, and it was his mother, who's a remarkable woman called Zhang Xianling. She spent months and months and months tracking exactly how her son had died and what had happened next. And for her, it was a really hard process of discovery because every fact seemed worse than the fact before. So he was lying in the street, and he was bleeding, and passers-by tried to help him, and they were told they couldn't touch him. An ambulance arrived, tried to treat him or take him to hospital, and they were also told by the soldiers, you mustn't touch him. If you touch him, we'll open fire on you. So he was left bleeding by the side of the street until he died. Mm. And after he died, his mother subsequently discovered that they just dug a shallow grave in a flower bed by the side of the road and buried his body there. When he didn't come home, she didn't know where he was. And she waited and waited and waited, and it took 10 days until she was told, until his body was found. And it was really only found because in this shallow grave, his corpse had begun to decompose and had begun to smell. And so they had to dig up the body. And just because he was wearing a military, he happened to be wearing a military belt, and because he was very young, they thought that it was a soldier's body. So instead of just cremating it as an unknown rioter, that's what people who died that day, that's the designation they were given by the state, the authorities thought he was a soldier, so they sent his body to a hospital, and that's where his parents finally claimed him. And his mother, she started at this group called the Tiananmen Mothers, which is a group of relatives of those that died. So she and another woman called Ding Zilin, who's really become the public face of the group, and they've spent the last 25 years campaigning, this sort of very determined group, mainly of elderly women, who've mm-hmm. become a real challenge to the state because they refuse to forget, and their demands have remained constant all these years for truth, accountability, and compensation.
One of the things I think that's so powerful that you tell about her story is that in 1998, she held a modest remembrance service where he died. And the next year, on the day, she was barred from leaving her apartment. And I just want to read something from the book. However, someone will always be watching her. A closed-circuit camera has been installed and trained on the exact spot where her son's body was exhumed. It is a camera dedicated to her alone, waiting for her in case she should ever again try to mourn her dead son. It's really just shocking that they would devote that amount of attention.
It is shocking. And, I mean, at certain times of the year, she has sometimes up to 40 people whose job is to watch her. And, you know, she laughs about it because she's so used to it now. You know, they follow her to the doctors. They go to the vegetable market with her. And she has tried to turn it around. So what she's started to do is, on the 20th anniversary, she started handing out her essay to anybody who was watching her, explaining what happened to her and explaining why she was being watched. And this year as well, she has been detained, and the latest reports have said she's unable to leave her house. But she herself is very clear about why the state needs to take this action. I mean, she believes that the government is afraid. She said, "I can't believe they're afraid of us, this group of old people, but that's because of what we represent. We represent righteousness."
Well, that is obviously just one story from the book, which covers many interesting and important stories, not only about Tiananmen, but also what you call the sort of second Tiananmen, what happened in Chengdu at that time. The book is a powerful work of documentation. Louisa Lim, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sure. The book, again, is The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited by Louisa Lim. Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new this week?
There's a bunch on both the fiction and nonfiction hardcover lists, and it's a bad week for women. Every new title, there are 10 new titles, 13 new authors, because three of them have co-writers. They are all by men. So let's run down this very masculine list.
Well, we still got Donna Tartt hanging on there at number two.
Yeah, that's true. And Maxine Petro with James Patterson at number one.
Oh, right. Okay. And Soo-Myung Kid.
So, yes, there are some women on the list. But let's do the men right now. New at number 11, Douglas Preston has a new book out called The Kraken Project. That's K-R-A-K-E-N. And that is about a CIA agent, Wyman Ford, who Preston has written about before. Then at number 10, James Rollins and Grant Blackwood start a new military series with a book called The Kill Switch.
This is the one about the military dog.
It is. It's about the military dog, Kane, in fact, whom with his owner, Captain Tucker Wayne, investigate a deadly biological threat.
We are keeping a straight face.
That's the start of a new series. Then at number 8, the continuation of an old series. Jeffrey Deaver, who wrote The Bone Collector, got made into a Denzel Washington movie a number of years back, has sort of a follow-up to that book. It's called The Skin Collector. So we got skin and bones here. This is, I think, the 11th or 12th book in his Lincoln Rhyme series about a forensic detective who's also in a wheelchair. And then at number seven, Joe Nesbo, who, of course, has the Harry Hole series, he's got a new book out that is not part of that Harry Hole series. It's a book called The Sun. It's a standalone about an escaped prisoner who is seeking vengeance on a corrupt police force.
All these light romances for summer.
I told you it's a masculine list.
Next in the lineup.
and finally in the lineup, the top-ranking new book on the hardcover fiction list this week is by Craig Johnson. It's at number six, and it's called Any Other Name. This is the 11th book in Craig Johnson's Longmire series, which is has since been turned into an A&E show.
All right, moving over to nonfiction.
Nonfiction, new at number 12 this week. The radio and TV host Adam Carolla has a book of kind of political commentary and humor, so-called, called President Me out. Then at number six, Jonathan Bush, who is part of the Bush family. I believe he's a cousin. And he's also the chief executive of the health technology company AthenaCare. He has a book out called Where Does It Hurt? That is all about the healthcare industry. That book is co-written with Stephen Baker. Then at number five, the journalist Glenn Greenwald, who, of course, broke the Edward Snowden story, has a book out called No Place to Hide. And that is about the Edward Snowden story and about his role in it. And then at number four, the former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has a memoir and a look at the financial crisis and his role in the financial crisis. That book is called Stress Test. That's new at number four. And then finally, Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner, who wrote the mega bestseller Freakonomics several years ago, have a book new at number two called Think Like a Freak.
Work in the original title.
It's a follow-up to Freakonomics, just talking about how you can solve problems creatively.
All right. Well, I guess lots of how-tos in a certain way on this list. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.